Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Philip Giraldi, who was for 17 years a CIA operative specializing in counterterrorism, who served in Europe and the Middle East. He now works in the private sector doing security consulting, and he writes for the American Conservative on international security issues. Phil Giraldi was one of the few who early on expressed concern in his column and elsewhere that those who brought us the war in Iraq, the neoconservatives, were focusing considerable attention on Iran. He reported in 2005 that Vice President Cheney had tasked Stratcom to develop a plan of attack utilizing conventional and nuclear forces against Iran. So we'll be talking, obviously, about the exit of Portugas. Apparently, he lost a battle with the new intelligence czar, Negroponte, the director of national intelligence. But there's also a much more realistic possibility that a burgeoning scandal, which has been dubbed Hookergate, may well have played a part in this. And we'll explore those possibilities. And then we'll also talk with Charlie Savage, who's a legal affairs reporter based in Washington for the Boston Globe. He's the author of important recent articles which have received attention worldwide and prompted a number of editorials, including one in the New York Times entitled "Bush Challenges Hundreds of Laws, a Veto, Who Needs a Veto?" And we'll be talking to Charlie Savage about the fact that President Bush has claimed the right to disobey over 750 laws, assuming a level of power hitherto unseen in an American president. I'm speaking with Phil Giraldi, who I mentioned, 17-year CIA operations officer specializing in counterterrorism, served in Europe and the Middle East. And obviously there's more to this resignation of Portugas on Friday than meets the eye, Phil Giraldi. I mean, the 900-pound gorilla in the room in the photo op with Portugas sitting next to George W. Bush was the fact that there was absolutely no mention of why he was leaving.
Right.
Talk about, as I say, a 900-pound gorilla. What do you think the reasons are?
Well, I think it's quite clear that Portugas was on the way out anyway. Portugas has been fairly open in senior staff meetings at CIA, letting numerous hints drop that he would be leaving sooner rather than later. But the fact is, the timing of this was somewhat bizarre. It was kind of an unscripted and surprise meeting to announce that he was leaving. And I think that was very much driven by the scandal that you were referring to, which is the investigation of the number three guy at the agency, Kyle Dusty Fago. I mean, you couldn't make up a name better than that one, but I think that's what's driven this process.
Well, there's some other good names, like Buzzy Krongard, who apparently is perhaps an enemy of Dusty Fago, since Dusty Fago was promoted out of nowhere by Portugas, and he pushed Buzzy Krongard aside.
That's right. Yeah, he replaced him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so but just some context for the scandal. This goes back to Randy Duke Cunningham, the congressman who's now in jail, who was receiving favors from defense contractors who bought a house for him and Rolls Royces and yachts and all of this stuff that you'd think somebody on the Hill might have noticed was a little above his pay grade. Nevertheless, there is apparently the U.S. attorney down in San Diego is looking into some further fallout from that case that may involve Dusty Fago and, of course, Brent Wilkes, who's the contractor that is apparently being looked at, and Mitchell Wade, the other contractor, has been convicted. So that's a sort of rough sketch of the situation. What about the? I'd like to talk further about that, Phil. But let's talk about what the press are reporting, and that is that this was a result of a struggle between the director of national intelligence, John Negroponte, and Portugas, and that effectively Goss lost and had to resign. So, if this is true, what is the DNI trying to take away from the CIA?
Well, apparently, from what I'm hearing, the specific issue, there are a lot of issues involved or that come into this, but the specific issue was over the CIA analysts who cover Iraq. Apparently, Negroponte decided that he was more or less going to take over the analysts en masse and move them over to his organization. Goss apparently resisted this. A side issue on this is the fact that the White House has been pushing for this move because the White House has not been very happy with what CIA analysts have been saying about Iraq. They wanted them to be in an environment where presumably they would be more sensitized to the point of view of the White House.
Well, that is the criticism that I've heard of Negroponte that comes from the INR, the State Department's defense. Their intelligence shop. When Negroponte succeeded Bremer as the sort of the proconsul in Iraq. Apparently, the stuff that he was sending back as, quote, intelligence, Colin Powell ripped it up and was disdainful, saying, this is not intelligence, this is public relations.
Well, that's right. Well, Negroponte obviously is in the job he's in because of that skill. The fact is that concurrently when he was in Iraq, the CIA station chief was sending back independent reports saying that the situation in Iraq was bad and getting worse. And as he was sending these reports back, Negroponte was doing everything he could to undercut that message and eventually got the CIA station chief replaced and punished when he got back to Washington.
So this is then a more of an issue of an administration at the very top, and that would be the president, the vice president, Cheney, and the secretary, Rumsfeld, in particular, and perhaps even Condoleezza Rice, I'm not sure, are living in a kind of cocoon, and they don't want reality to intrude. Is that...
Well, I think you could argue that some of them are in a cocoon. I mean, certainly it has been argued plausibly that the president is. I think some of the others are intelligent enough to know that what they're selling is snake oil. But the fact is they are on... What is the story of the man who's riding the tiger? It's hard to get off. And I think that the essence is here that you have some people who are intelligent, who are knowledgeable of the situation, but they can't really admit to the reality of it because it would be a repudiation of everything that's been done in the past 5 years.
But much of this new structure is a result of post 9/11 and the 9/11 Commission and what the Congress has done, and it seems, you know, just in broad strokes, I've always felt that the WMD meltdown and the failure to see 9/11, even though there were some clear signs, following those two intelligence meltdowns, it's as though, you know, you have a car accident and they're blaming the car, not the driver. And it seems to be that has been what's been going on here. And now the Congress have set up this mechanism, which is essentially a political layer that doesn't really have any... is trying to sort of accrue assets from the most vulnerable, which is the CIA... But at the same time, leaving the real 900-pound gorilla in terms of the intelligence budget, the DOD, unscathed. So yeah. What's going on here?
Well, what's going on here is basically you're having, in addition to the obvious issues of intelligence failure, and I wouldn't be too, you know, I wouldn't lean too far in that direction because clearly on 60 Minutes a couple of weeks ago, the CIA officer who was in charge for Europe basically said the agency was reporting a lot of this stuff. It just was not being... the filtering process didn't allow it to get to the top because the political decisions had already been made. So you have to put that into the hopper, too. But at the same time, there is a power play going on in Washington with a number of players. And the Pentagon clearly has been the biggest winner in terms of aggrandizing itself as the lead intelligence agency in the United States, and has done this in sort of a stealth fashion. And Negroponte, being very much a player who's going to do what the administration wants to do, has basically assisted this process by what he's been doing to the agency.
But DOD have most of the assets, and over the years they've taken assets away from the CIA. The CIA used to be able to analyze the satellite, the overhead imagery first, and that's been taken away. I mean, the Air Force just shut down the SR-71, the Blackbird program, because they weren't getting the take. And that was just before the first Gulf War, where the planes would have been useful. So there seems to be a history here of this these turf battles that don't really make much sense in terms of the nation's security.
Well, they don't make much sense for the taxpayer or for the nation's security. But the fact is, this is the reality of Washington. And the current reality is that the CIA is very much in disrepute with the White House because it is, to a large extent, seen as not towing the White House line. And the Defense Department is. And the Defense Department, I might add to what you said, has also begun to run agents, clandestine agents overseas, which was exclusively the responsibility of the CIA up until fairly recently.
But the Defense Department's run by their intelligence, overall intelligence is run by Stephen Cambone, who's the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Intelligence, who is a very much in the neocon camp and doesn't appear to be have much of a very broad view of the world. Then you've got Lieutenant General William Boykin as his deputy, and he's been in trouble for being a kind of apocalyptic Christian, which you would think would be a conflict of interest in if you're in the military. You shouldn't have an investment in the end of the world and the rapture.
Right.
So just on the surface, I'd say the people who are running intel at the DOD are embarrassing.
Well, I would certainly agree with you, but of course I feel that intelligence should be a civilian function anyway, I think that in this case the people who've managed to rise to the surface in this are zealots essentially, and they have an agenda. And if you're an intelligence officer, that's the one thing you really don't want to have. You want to be able to go into every situation that you're looking at with a clear optic. And be able to make judgments that are based on information and not based on a pre-existing agenda. But unfortunately, that's what the neoconservatives are all about.
But in terms of, you just mentioned that you should have as civilian leaders of the intelligence, not military leaders. And the person being touted to replace Portegas is an Air Force general, Mike Hayden, who's Negroponte's deputy. Hayden himself doesn't seem to understand the Fourth Amendment. When he was questioned after the NSA wiretapping story broke, his responses were frankly scary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Hayden was one of the architects of the eavesdropping program. So he would be a terrible choice, and he's also a terrible choice in that he comes out of the military context. He obviously is close to Donald Rumsfeld and is close to Negroponte, both who are people that are actively undercutting the role of the agency. So how do you send someone over to run an organization that basically has a fundamental antipathy towards it?
Well, it does seem to be some reservations on the Hill, particularly the chair of the House Intelligence Committee doesn't seem to think it's a good idea to have a military guy running the CIA. So, do you think if he is nominated, he may have some difficulties in confirmation?
I quite honestly don't see that. I think that unfortunately the polarization in Washington is such that the Republicans still basically will toe the party line on this and will go along with the White House. And I think that's very unfortunate, but I think that's kind of the way it's going to play out. There will be some criticism and there will be some naysaying, but I think essentially this is an appointment that the president could win on.
Well, if he were though to be less confrontational, he could put Mary Margaret Graham up, right? The deputy.
Yeah, he could do that. Or if he wanted to be more confrontational, he could put Francis Townsend, his personal advisor on counterterrorism issues, as the appointee. But she has no qualifications whatsoever for the position.
No, that would be like putting up his lawyer for the Supreme
Exactly.
Court.
Exactly. It would be the same situation.
Right. But Mary Margaret Graham, she left when Portegas came in, and his aides from the Hill, the so-called Goslings, mm-hmm. Cleaned house there, or drove a lot of talent out, including Tyler Drumheller, and Buzzy Krongard got driven out too, right?
Right, right.
So give us a sense, for, as a former intelligence officer, you know, your feeling about the idea that's been expressed that the first thing that happened when you brought in a partisan politician, albeit a former operations officer, Port Augusta, the result was that hundreds of years of institutional knowledge went out the door.
Well, that's kind of a simplistic analysis. I think that the corruption took place before that. It took place under George Tenet, who was the first director ever seriously to politicize the job, both for Democrats and for Republicans. So let's not forget that. And also, Tenet had kind of a ripple effect where he appointed people to senior positions in the agency like James Pavitt, who were of a like mind and who had a very political interpretation of how they were supposed to do their jobs. So the problem started there. And then Goss coming in. Goss was, if you talk to people inside the agency, I think they would agree that Goss was essentially not a candidate to make the intelligence function better. He was a candidate to kind of clean house in the sense of getting the CIA on board with the White House. And that may have been a Herculean task in any event, because intelligence people tend to be kind of independent-minded. But I think that was his task. It wasn't really a question of making the product work better. It was just making the product more responsive.
And in terms of the apparatchiks that came in from the intelligence committees, his staff, as we both know, the intelligence committees have essentially, particularly one in the Senate, have sat on all efforts to find out what happened with WMD. The so-called Phase 2 has been stopped dead in its tracks, in spite of the fact that the Democrats shut the Senate down. It doesn't seem to be going anywhere. What's the latest on whether we'll ever find out about the use of intelligence?
Well, I don't think we will find out unless there's serious regime change in Washington, meaning the Democrats take over both houses and are willing to take on the issue, which I don't see either, because certainly there is enough mud to stick on the Democrats for many of the things that have happened in the past 5 years, and they don't want to open that can of worms either.
Well, they've, Rockefeller has not proven to be particularly aggressive, and neither has Jane Harman in terms
right.
of sticking up for the truth and being advocates for the public.
Exactly.
So what do you know, Phil Giraldi, about Pat Murray, who's one of the Goslings, so-called Goslings, one of the staffers? I think he's Goss's chief deputy, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. He's the number one Gosling, and he's certainly been a lightning rod for a lot of the criticism. Goss himself has what might be described, or had since he's gone, might be described as a hands-off style in terms of personnel management and that sort of thing. So he has been noted for making a number of inept comments about any kind of critique or anything coming from inside the organization. Murray has been his point man on a lot of this stuff and has been the person who has actually been involved with the forced resignations of a number of senior officers by putting them in an untenable position. So he's been the point man on that and very much the lightning rod for the resentment against Goss.
So he's sort of the executioner.
Right, he is. He's a hitman.
Well, but interestingly enough, he's the guy that apparently went to these poker parties.
That's one story. Obviously the Fago, it's claimed that Fago was at these parties too, and it's also been claimed by some sources that Goss himself went to a number of these parties. And
right.
The parties obviously had congressmen also there and congressional staffers and other senior government officials, and also involved, from what I've been hearing, prostitutes and other activity.
Well, apparently, Fargo was pretty much a regular, and he was the sort of, I think, the in effect, the reasons for these parties, which they started out at his home, apparently, in Vienna, and then moved to the Watergate and then later the Western Hotel. And apparently, from what I'm told, Pat Murray was a regular at these things. Now, there's no suggestion that the prostitutes were at the poker parties, but there is a suggestion that the limousine service that was used to bring them back and forth was, in fact, the way that that those deals were transacted. And this you have to go back to the original Cunningham case to find this kind of link. Now, apparently the FBI investigation is continuing, and they've been interviewing people about this limousine service that has featured in this thing. And what is particularly dismaying about this limousine service is that that they got a contract, a $25 million contract with the Department of Homeland Security, when the head of the limousine service is a convicted felon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it's just more and more incredible when you hear more about the details of the arrangements that were made and what occurred. But I mean, it's absolutely in character with a lot of people who felt they were bulletproof, that they could do anything and they could arrange anything and it really didn't matter and there's no accountability. Ultimately, the issue to me is that with this administration, with this White House, there is no accountability and there has been no accountability. And when you're in that kind of environment, corruption takes over.
Well, the limousine service, Sherlingham, apparently is also in the FBI's crosshairs, and Mitchell Wade, the military contractor who worked with Brett Wilkes, the guy that organized these poker parties, and was as a high school buddy of Dusty Fogo's, he's singing like a canary, if I understand Mitchell Wade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this is, I guess, what's probably going to happen here, even though there's some rumor that Dusty Fogo might be indicted along with Brett Wilkes. If that rumor is correct, then perhaps that's why Goss got out.
Yeah, I would say that is the reason Goss got out. I think that if Fogo is indicted, then certainly there's a strong case for Goss having to dissociate himself as quickly as he could. And even if he's not indicted, I think there's enough mud sticking to this situation where Goss's position, given his other issues. I mean, and let's not forget that Goss is incredibly unpopular inside the agency. There's the recent Mary McCarthy firing, which turned out to be a fiasco, where she had allegedly leaked information, or the agency leaked the story that she had leaked information, and then it turned out that she emphatically denied that, and the agency even had to admit that she had only been fired just for meeting with a journalist, not for giving information. So that was a fiasco, and so Goss had a lot of other liabilities, and this was only, I think, the icing on the cake.
Well, wasn't that a case where Goss was under pressure from Cheney to deliver a scalp?
Yeah. Yeah, there have been a number of cases that I've heard about that Goss was pressured when analysts in particular or senior officers were not saying things or analyzing things in a way that the White House felt was acceptable. And, yeah, there has been pressure to do that. And in a couple of cases, Goss went along with the pressure and reassigned people and did that sort of thing. Yes, that's true.
Well, the poker parties, there's a description of these poker parties from an insider who attended the poker parties, where they describe them in the downtown hotels, Watergate, and then later the Westin. Brent Wilkes would invite Randy Duke, Cunningham, and some other denizens from the Hill. And you were saying earlier that the staffers and I believe some other congressmen are involved.
Mm-hmm.
So
should
we expect some indictments here or some?
Well, I think we will. And you know, but again, this is going to be a kind of a traditional Washington dance in that there are some people that are clearly going to be sacrificed, and other people are going to be protected in this process. Let's face it. I mean, if you're going to be prosecuting these people, the Attorney General has to go along with that. It's not just the FBI that can do it by itself. And if the Attorney General is not interested in going after a lot of leading Republicans or senior government officials in this administration, then it's going to not happen or happen in a way that's controlled and mitigated.
So even though the FBI are developing, apparently, a case against all of, you know, what went on in these poker parties, and particularly with the limousine service that was delivering hookers, what happens? You think that that Gonzalez is going to slow this down? Or, I mean, I guess the Republicans can't afford to lose too many House seats, right?
Well, Gonzalez is certainly not going to speed it up, let's put it that way. And he's not going to what he's going to try to do is he's going to try to make this process kind of spin out so that you don't have a lot of indictments coming down before November elections. That would be the main game plan. But there would be a second game plan, which would be basically to try to mitigate this process in general to make it less damaging to the Republican Party. I mean, that's a given.
So in other words, the focus will be on frying Dusty Fargo, and
Fargo's fair game. Absolutely,
I see. Yeah. Well, what just though, get back to the real issue here, which is what's happening to this country's ability to look at what's happening in the world and to make real world assessments. And if we have a government that is increasingly becoming cocooned in their own delusions, and that this is the purpose of having the Negroponte's is actually rather than centralizing the flow of intelligence, and now he's taken over the president's briefings, which is a battle that Portugos lost.
Right.
Are we really in a situation where it's the sort of blind leading the dumb?
Well, it might even be worse than that, actually. I mean, the problem is that you have an administration that sees things in very bipolar terms, in terms of black and white, in terms of good and evil. How else do you explain Cheney's comments to the Russians this past 2 weeks, which were gratuitous and totally unhelpful in terms of the role Russia might be playing in terms of Iran and other places? So this is a regime that does not see things with any objectivity. So, to a certain extent, what significance does intelligence play anyway? If you come in with an agenda, and your agenda is that we have to attack Iran because Iran might get nuclear weapons and might be a threat, and the agenda drives the intelligence, where the intelligence, no matter what it says, is kind of irrelevant, what do you have at the end of the day? You have basically a situation in which you're going to go to war, whether or not there is a justification based on the information that you've been out and collecting.
So, if the White House has a predilection to go their own way and they don't want to be bothered by the facts, what's been the role of the Congress here? I mean, the oversight, it seems to me that that's where it's really broken down, that the intelligence committees have gone along, and this includes the Democrats on them, have gone along with this whole kind of myth of intelligence reform.
Well, I think to a certain extent, there are two problems. One problem is the Democratic Party, which has been boxed into a corner very successfully by the Republicans on security and defense issues, and is afraid to take a position that would in any way seem to label it as weak. And the problem in the Republican Party is that the Republican Party has been co-opted over the last 5 or 6 years and basically is no longer a traditional Republican Party. It's basically a party that is identified with Bush and the Bush administration and with loyalty to Bush as the key issues.
So, and of course, this rubber stamp nature that you're describing will be the issue that the Democrats will use against them in the November elections, I'm sure.
I believe they will. The question is, how successfully will they do it? Because the Democrats, of course, have their own credibility problem in that they haven't been able to stake out any positions that resonate with the voters.
Right, and they've got win 16 seats. to get back into the majority, and here they are losing, the potentially losing their own seats. Patrick Kennedy's in Rhode Island, Jefferson down in New Orleans, the West Virginia congressman is the charge of the ethics, who's got ethical problems.
Right.
When the Republicans are on the run, you can always count on the Democrats for shooting themselves in the foot, it seems.
That's precisely what's happening, yeah.
It's quite surreal. But just in terms of what's been done in the name of intelligence reform so far, we talked about the DNI's basically being a political layer, and Negroponte is a diplomat who tells Bush what he wants to hear, and has been promoted for that very purpose. But this big white elephant that they build out there in Virginia, what's that all about? This National Counterterrorism Center.
Well, to me, it was a misguided concept right from the beginning. I think the original idea, if you look back at the original congressional reports and reviews, was to create a center where there was a better sharing of information and better synthesis of the activities that were taking place from the various intelligence agencies. That was a good idea. The problem was that it already existed. The CIA had its counterterrorism center, which essentially was set up to do just that. So it would have been much more intelligent to use the existing structure and not create another layer of bureaucracy, particularly a very politicized layer of bureaucracy, and go with what you had. But all they've done now is just they've created another monster, and another monster means that you have another step to go through every time intelligence is collected somewhere in the world and has to arrive at a policymaker at the top. So it to me, it has never been a good idea.
So here we are in the middle of a war in Iraq that every day, I don't know whether people in this country are getting inured to the violence, because you just turn on the radio and it's 20, 30 killed. Today there were a whole bunch of incidents, in Karbala in particular. But as General Odom recently pointed out in an op-ed piece, that's also an excerpt from an article he has in Foreign Affairs, Iraqis are killing Iraqis. That means it's a civil war. Mm-hmm. So as things go south in Iraq, and our leadership are living in their own sort of fantasy world, that everything is going great, and that when they stand up, we'll stand down. When does reality intrude on this, do you think? I mean, what will it take or are these guys just running this country just don't know what to do, and they can't accept the reality that it's a complete screw up? What's your reading on it, Phil?
Well, my reading is that politics is all about obtaining power and keeping power, and it really has nothing to do with what's good for the country or what's good for the world. And in that light, this administration is basically like any administration. If we had Bill Clinton here, we'd be doing the same thing. There are delaying tactics. There are various things being done to spin this out so that the reality of it never really bites. But eventually, these events have a way of catching up with you. And it might take something very much like, if you recall back in 1975, with the American helicopters flying off the roof of the embassy and being dumped at sea, we could be moving to something like that. And eventually, I think most people who pay attention to what's going on in Iraq, as clearly you do, realize that the situation in that part of the world, and as we're playing it, is untenable. And someday, this is all going to play out to the discomfort of people who are in politics, and to the it'll be a disaster for the United States.
But how can then they be planning? As you were one of the first people to reveal plans to attack that Rumsfeld has tasked Stratcom to come up with plans to attack Iraq that may also include use of nuclear weapons. Is this? I mean, I think a lot of analysts see this as digging the hole deeper. Would there be a motive in terms of the November elections possible here? In other words, if you go back to the beginning of the Iraq War in March of 2003, all of the media in this country is guilty of shameless jingoism and building up this, making the war look like an entertainment. Operation Iraqi Freedom and all that, you know, they even composed musical scores.
Right.
So could we go through that again with Iran, where, in other words, there was a movie a while back called Wag the Dog, so which sort of suggests that you don't have to do that much on the ground to create war fever.
Right.
It's almost like a theatrical device. So.
Well, I'm afraid we are seeing that again. I mean, clearly they've already succeeded, and the fearmongers about Iran have already succeeded in among the public creating the impression that Iran is a great threat. Anyone who knows anything about the situation realizes that it is not. But nevertheless, the fear-mongering has already started. And I think what you're alluding to is the possibility that a war or some military action against Iran could be a way of galvanizing the conservative base of the administration and could be perceived as a plus for the impending November elections. That's definitely a possibility. I think that's a horrific possibility. But I wouldn't necessarily rule that out.
Well, what do you think, though, since you've already reported on plans? What are they doing? Are they seriously want, the president saying, no, we want a diplomatic track? I have a feeling that the Russians may well be playing us on this one, that they're not being particularly helpful. They just supplied the Iranians with the top-of-the-line anti-aircraft missiles at the same time. They're launching Israeli spy satellites to monitor Iran. So that's almost like they're playing both sides. And they're not being helpful in terms of sanctions. So I get the impression that perhaps the Russians might, and Putin, you know, KGB Incorporated that run Russia, may well be sort of happy to see America blunder in the Middle East, to have the Straits of Hormuz mined, the oil supply from the Gulf stopped, oil goes up hundreds of dollars a barrel. Who would be the winner in that?
Well,
Russia.
Obviously the world would be a loser.
But Russia would be the huge winner, wouldn't they?
Russia is certainly going to play their self-interest. I mean, and anyone who assumes that they would not be doing that is mistaken. They're going to play every side of every issue in terms of where their own interests and where their long-term interests lie. Now, in terms of what the administration should be doing with Iran, is Iran has been for a long time now sending all kinds of signals, and Seymour Hersh's recent pieces have gone into a lot of detail on this, that they want bilateral talks with the United States. The United States, for reasons that are completely unclear to me, has refused to do this. So the Iran issue is a manageable political issue, but there has been an agenda-driven kind of response by the U.S. administration and an unwillingness to deal with this in any kind of diplomatic way.
So, in other words, you're suggesting that because they've chosen to make this a crisis with Iran, that they may have an ulterior motive.
Right.
And could it... So it's one of two possibilities. Either they're sort of bluffing in it and it could get out of hand, or they're crazy and they really want to go to war.
Well, I must admit I veered more towards the second. It seems to me there's an atmosphere of unreason that it's coming out of Washington on this issue and on many other issues, and I don't understand it. And I keep hearing people who are close to the administration saying things like, well, whatever might, the option of a military strike on Iran before November elections is just off the board because it's too dangerous. But at the same time, I keep hearing that, military options do galvanize the party base, do galvanize the country. They rally the people around the administration, and it's not exactly unthinkable.
Well, on that note, I thank you for joining us, Phil Giraldi, and for filling us in on the real reasons behind Portugas's resignation.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Philip Giraldi, who's 17-year CIA veteran operations officer specializing in counterterrorism. He served in Europe and the Middle East, and he was one of the few, he writes for the American Conservative, and he is one of the few analysts who early on suggested that the neocons who brought us Iraq were now focusing their attention on Iran, and reported in 2005 that Vice President Cheney had tasked Stratcom to develop a plan of attack utilizing conventional and nuclear forces against Iran. I'm now speaking with Charlie Savage, who's a legal affairs reporter based in Washington for the Boston Globe, and he's the author of an important recent article which has received attention worldwide and prompted a number of editorials, including one in the New York Times titled Veto, Who Needs a Veto? And in the article, Charlie Savage shows that President Bush has claimed a right to disobey over 750 laws, therefore assuming a level of power heretofore unseen in an American president. And by contrast, in Bush Sr.'s one term, he issued 232 of these presidential signing statements. And in Bill Clinton's 8 years, he issued 140, so 750 in, 6 years? So why are we in this country? I mean, your editorial, your study, Charlie, has been featured in a number of European papers and in the rest of the world. It should be greeted with outrage here, because it is such a flagrant violation of the Constitution, where you have the president has veto power, and this president has never used a veto, and why should he? Because he's got the presidential signing statements.
Well, that's right. It's been an abiding mystery of this administration why President Bush, who in every other aspect has such an awesome conception of executive power and what a president should be able to do unilaterally, has never once vetoed a bill. No one since Thomas Jefferson in the early 19th century has gone this far without vetoing a bill. And only once you read these signing statements, which no one ever reads outside the executive branch, do you begin to get an understanding of why that may be, which is that to the extent that this works, and for 5 years it has worked, because no one has read them or raised alarms, a president can use these to selectively take out chunks of legislation which he does not like, keep the rest, do it in a way that the public and the Congress pays no attention to, and effectively have an override-proof line item veto.
Well, it's worth noting that this device, this presidential signing statement, began with Ed Meese in the Reagan administration. And the person, the lawyer who was the sort of zealot who put together this idea of this unitary presidency, is none other than the Supreme Court justice who was just appointed, Samuel Alito.
For the benefit of your listeners who have not read my piece, and I encourage them to, it's still free on the website of the Boston Globe.
Well, give me the website.
Well, it'd be bostonglobe.com. Or you could just Google my name, and the first article comes up because it's been linked to so much. It's sort of an extraordinary response. What I was going to say is the history of this goes actually way back into the 19th century. On rare occasions, presidents have said, "I am not going to enforce a law because I think that this law is unconstitutional." And they've occasionally issued signing statements to that effect when signing a new bill and they think has a provision in it that's unconstitutional. In the mid-80s, that practice became a lot more regular under the direction of Ed Meese, as you mentioned. And Sam Alito wrote this strategy memo about it in 1986, which came out last year when we were all going over his old papers during his confirmation fight. But I've noticed in the blogosphere, as people talk about this, they've characterized it not unlike you just did, as if this was all Sam Alito's grand design. And I think that is something somewhat unfair, because if you look at what Sam Alito was suggesting, he was suggesting to use this power very cautiously, to do it infrequently, not to contradict Congress directly, and to use it primarily just when there's some sloppy language in a bill that later on is going to generate a court case. Courts will go back and look at what Congress intended when they wrote that law. He said maybe we should get some presidential influence over that by leaving a record of what we think this language means when we sign it. This is completely different than what President Bush is doing. President Bush's 750 signing statements, the vast majority of these are by design never going to get into court. This is not for a judge later on to say, well, what did President Bush think when he signed it? These are instructions to the bureaucracy about his own powers and Congress's lack of ability to regulate his powers, in his view, so that when they implement the law and come up with a policy, they do so in a way that does not concede that Congress can put any limits on what Bush can do, either with the executive branch, civilian side, or with the military. And because these things are, especially in the national security area, very secret or happen overseas, they're never going to get into court. This is a final say on his own powers. It's very different than what Sam Alito was talking about when he was saying, let's do this cautiously, let's do this so that a judge can understand it. I don't think that he deserves a bad rap for this.
Well, no, and I think that the example to give the audience to show how brazen this president is in his use of the presidential signing statement, when they had an extraordinary vote in the Senate, John McCain put it forth, to ban torture, where they, you know, this rather supine rubber stamp Congress sort of stood up and got a, I think, 96-0 vote. The president then turns around and says he's not bound by this congressional ban on torture of prisoners.
That's right. That is the most notorious of the signing statements. It's the first one that I wrote about, and it's what got me interested in going back and reading all of them, which no one had read, which generated last Sunday's piece. For your viewers will understand that, or remember that there was this big fight in Congress late last year over whether or not there was going to be a ban on torture by U.S. interrogators, no matter where they were in the world. Probably that was already illegal under U.S. law, but the administration had come up with a contorted legal argument about why they could get around it overseas. John McCain, himself a victim of torture in Vietnam, made it his signature issue last year to try to get that locked down. The Bush administration fought very hard. Bush threatened to veto it, even though he's never vetoed anything. Dick Cheney went to the Hill at least once, and I think maybe twice, to personally lobby key lawmakers not to do this. But in the end, Republicans came together with Democrats in both chambers and overwhelmingly passed this law. And then Bush called a press conference, had the cameras come in with John McCain, said that he was accepting it, that in fact it was a good idea, sort of trying to take credit for it, kind of ludicrously. Then he signs the bill, and on late night, Friday night, before New Year's Eve weekend, he enters into the federal record one of these signing statements saying, despite all that, the military should keep in mind, and the CIA, I take it, when later policies are being drafted under this, that I am the commander-in-chief. Congress cannot limit my ability to order and authorize, you know, torture if I think that that's necessary to, help stop terrorist attacks. So, you know, there was outrage when this became known. Even among Republican senators, who said, wait a minute, you asked us for a waiver, we said you couldn't have it, we have the power to regulate the military, but under Bush's view of the Constitution, they don't have that power.
Tell me, Charlie Savage, in terms of the 750-plus presidential signing statements that the president has issued after the Congress and laws have been passed, and when he signs them, he's basically saying, I'm signing this, but I don't believe it,
right.
Making it moot. You say that the national security has been the dominant rubric under which president has exclaimed these extraordinary powers. But a lot of these 750 laws to do with other things like the environment, aren't they?
I don't remember any specifically about the environment, though that may be in the pile. I would say that national security is a big one of them, and control of the executive branch is a big one of them. But this extends well beyond national security. You're right. Famously, we just talked about the torture ban, mm-hmm. and another one in March was waiving all the oversight provisions of the Patriot Act that had been added to get the bill reauthorized. Members of Congress voted to reauthorize the Patriot Act only because they were going to get these additional oversight. You know, we have to get reports about how you're using all these various surveillance powers. Bush said he could withhold that information after he signed the bill. But the other kinds of the other laws range all over the place. They are whistleblower provisions, which give executive branch officials the power to tell Congress about possible criminal activity in the executive branch without the president's permission. He says, no, they can't do that without being fired. Or at least he has the power to order them not to do that. So whistleblower provisions, all kinds of required reports and information to go to congressional oversight committees, safeguards against political interference in federally funded research, affirmative action provisions whenever Congress says, you know, the director of this agency shall recruit minorities, or some grants that are going to be made have to go to minority colleges as well as other ones. He always flags that as a violation of the Constitution, possibly under his view. But so it's all over the map. Many, many, many laws, and crushing by far all previous presidents' records as far as the number of laws that he says he can ignore under his reading of the Constitution.
So what happens when the bureaucracies, say, for example, FDA, you mentioned it, you know, he doesn't, he'll override research findings, perhaps on things like stem cells and others, and impose his will. What does the Congress do? I mean, what do the bureaucrats do when they get these mixed signals from a bill that the Congress has passed, and then the president has written this signing statement saying, "Ignore this."
Well, I mean, there's no doubt that the federal bureaucracy obeys the president. You know, that's what the whole purpose of this is. The president's legal views are binding on his underlings. As far as what, you know, what are the consequences of these things? In many cases, it's very hard to say. On the whistleblower provisions, for example, if a person who thinks that they want to be a whistleblower and thinks that they have some protection then looks at the signing statement and says, maybe my job is not safe, that person may never come forward, in which case there's no need ever to put into force whether or not you're going to protect that person's job or use the signing statement to punish them. Especially in the realm of the military and national security, where it's so hard to know what the government is doing, we may never know to what extent these are merely assertions on paper that the law does not apply to the president, does not bind the president, and he, you know, will do what he wants to do as a matter of choice rather than a mandate, or whether these are actually having a real-world, policy impact.
So, you tell me, you've gotten a lot of response. Obviously, a lot of it came from abroad, and the New York Times did have a lead editorial this week on Friday. What's the general tenor that you're getting? I mean, as people are shocked, but I guess the real question is, have they said, what do we do about it?
Well, I guess there's a couple of questions wrapped into that. Number one is, what has the reaction been? There's been a huge amount of discussion of this in the blogosphere. Quite a few non-print media have picked up on it, such as your show today. Not so much in print media, though there was that editorial in the Times, as you mentioned. But that's different. That's an editorial. That's not a, you know, another news article picking up on and pushing the ball forward. As far as what happens, you know, it's a political question primarily. As I mentioned earlier in the program, these kinds of claims are unlikely to be resolved in court. These are not the kinds of issues that get before the Supreme Court for the most part. So that leaves Congress as the third of the three branches that can sort of push back. On Tuesday, Senator Arlen Specter, who's the Republican from Pennsylvania, who's the chairman of the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, announced that he was going to hold hearings next month into these signing statements and into the broader claims that are being made here. There also have been a number of Democrats who have spoken out in response and are going to have, a resolution in the House condemning the practice. We'll see whether that passes. You know, it's a Democratic resolution, so it's probably not going to pass. But at the end of the day, this is the kind of dispute which has to be resolved politically. And one of the things that's interesting about this whole phenomenon is the way the U.S. Constitution is set up is such that power is supposed to be divided evenly, and Congress is supposed to have the power to write the law. The president is supposed to have the duty to enforce the law. And that's the duty which is being called into question by this practice. The founders anticipated that a president may, in fact, try to expand his own power in that way. They also anticipated that Congress, who are made up of individual men and women, would be jealous of their own power and would push back and would monitor this and not want to, because no one wants to give up power. What they did not anticipate was the degree to which party politics would come to be a dominant force in American politics. There weren't parties, lockstep parties 200 years ago the way they are today. And so the fact that Republicans control the White House and also control both chambers of Congress may be one explanation about why there's been less oversight on this issue until now, because the kind of vigorous pushback that would protect Congress's power to write the law would also damage the president and by, as a result, damage the same Republicans who might be calling those kinds of investigations.
But then you have this, you have the third branch, the judiciary. Normally, I thought that, the president would, that Congress had passed laws, the president would sign them, or if he was unhappy, he'd veto them, and then if they overrode the veto, then he'd have to sign them. And that the role of the judiciary was to review the constitutionality of these laws that were passed and signed. So here we have a Congress that's rolling over for the president because of party loyalty, which they certainly do seem to take to an extreme. But what about the judiciary? I mean, here the two newest justices, the Chief Justice and the Associate Justice Alito, who had a role in writing some of this, coming up with legal justifications for these presidential signing statements. They are both Roberts and Alito have a clear bias towards presidential authority. So if the legislative branch are rolling over, how far is the judicial branch rolling over?
Well, a couple of responses to that. Yes, definitely Roberts and Alito, one of the reasons President Bush picked them, there's no doubt, is because he shared their view of executive power. They were both formerly, had worked in the executive branch before they joined the judicial system, which is not to say we know how they will rule, but one of the criticism that was launched against them was they would be overly biased towards a claim of executive authority. We'll see, because they haven't had a chance yet to rule in such a case, how that will actually play out. But as I said earlier, a lot of these questions are never going to go into the judicial branch. These are not the kinds of, whether or not Bush has overstepped his bounds or come up with a too broad interpretation of the Constitution to knock down these military regulations that the Congress is trying to impose on him is not the kind of thing that ordinarily is going to get into court, because it's very hard to see who is the specific victim of that who also has standing to sue. Mm-hmm. Someone who is tortured in an overseas prison and is not a U.S. citizen, despite the torture ban, cannot sue in federal court. You have to be a U.S. citizen or be on U.S. soil to sue in federal court. So if you don't have someone suing, who you don't ever have the question brought before the Supreme Court in the first place. And that is why these become President Bush being the final arbiter of his own power when he says, I interpret the Constitution to give me broad authority and Congress very limited authority to, regulate what happens in the government.
I'm the decider.
That he is indeed the decider.
I thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Charlie Savage, who's a legal affairs reporter based in Washington for the Boston Globe, and he's the author of this important article, which points out that President Bush has reserved the right for himself to disobey over 750 laws passed by the Congress, and the reason he hasn't vetoed anything is that he doesn't have to. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Carol Cook, the assistant producer, the engineer, Jazz Shepherd.